the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
You might remember yesterday when Nancy Pelosi asked Trump to delay the State of the Union address, saying that unfunded security agencies weren't equipped to protect the speech during a government shutdown. Well, that makes sense. I mean, you can't have unpaid people guarding our leaders. Eagle has entered the building, and I need someone to take over my position because I got to get to my second job at Dollar Tree.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, uncharacteristically, there was no response yesterday from Donald Trump. And clearly, the president considered the chaos and the dysfunction that he has brought upon our government and the solemnity of the State of the Union, and cooler heads prevailed. I'm just kidding. Today, 45 minutes before she was supposed to visit NATO allies and our troops overseas, Trump sent Pelosi this letter. Due to the shutdown, I am sorry to inform you that your trip to Brussels, Egypt, and Afghanistan has been postponed. If I can't get my wall to keep people out of the country, you don't get to leave the country. Sorry, Nancy, no living it up in Afghanistan for you. Although with the shutdown, there was no way she was going to get through TSA in time anyway. Now, Trump has the power to do this because Pelosi was flying military transport and he's the commander-in-chief. But Trump did give her another option, saying, obviously, if you would like to make your journey by flying commercial, that would certainly be your prerogative. All right, she can fly commercial to Afghanistan. I'm sure JetBlue offers daily nonstop flights to a war zone.
You think?
Hello, folks. This is your captain. Just wanted you to look out. If you wanted to look out the left side of your plane right now, you can see the Khyber Pass. And if you look out the right side, you can see the smoking stump where our wing used to be. We will be landing slightly ahead of schedule. So you might not get to finish Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Now, it was
too bad. Shares awfully good.
Again, Pelosi wasn't on some pleasure cruise here. She was visiting the troops. And the trip to Afghanistan was a closely held secret due to security concerns. So basically, what Trump's letter said was, Nancy, feel free to go commercial now that I've told the Taliban that you're coming and staying at the Jalalabad La Quinta Inn. Plus, here's a shocker, the letter is not very good. Trump made a mistake in the very first line by misspelling Pelosi's name. He wrote, Dear Madam Speaker. Nancy Pelosi is actually Madam Speaker without the E. A Madam Speaker is what Trump uses to order at a drive-thru brothel.
I'll have the number one.
And that's not the only sign that the shutdown is really getting to the president. This morning he tweeted, the left has become totally unhinged. They no longer care what is right for our country. Yes. Yes.
Hey.
Yes, lefties. You're letting your country down.
Oh,
you're a disgrace
God.
To America.
America, which is what we should be calling this country right now. I'm sorry, but things are really fucked up. This country has gone from mediocre to shit. And a big part of it is the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House. But it's not only that. I got to tell you, last night there was a great piece of journalism that dropped. And it was from my friend, yes, my friend, Jason Leopold. If you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you've heard Jason Leopold on with me. Actually, we became friends through this radio show. I don't know. First time I spoke to him has got to be over 10 years ago. It was back in I guess, the WINZ days, even before Air America. And because Jason does great reporting. Now, a number of years ago, I had mentioned, you see how this is taking over the actual news? There's news, and then there's news about the news. But Jason Leopold has been attacked by somebody named Oliver Darcy at CNN, and it's really pissing me off. Because as it turns out, Oliver Darcy, who writes for, let's see, he's the... I don't have his thing up on Twitter, but apparently he writes media criticism under Brian Stelter, who I've got my issues with as it is. But Brian Stelter allegedly tries to be fair. He does. I watch his show on Sundays. But this guy, Oliver Darcy, I'm not going to link to it because you know what I may have. Oh, here it is. The headline at CNN Business: reporter with checkered past comes back with Trump Tower Moscow bombshells for BuzzFeed. With checkered past, Jason Leopold wrote a book years ago called News Junkie, and he talks about his struggles with mental illness, with substance abuse, with, you know, navigating all of it, and how he came out on the other side. I've talked about it on the air. I mentioned that when I downloaded it from my Kindle, and I couldn't put it down, and I read it in about a day. And I recommend it to anybody who reads. So that disqualifies Donald Trump. But anybody else, it's a great book. And this asshole, Oliver Darcy at CNN, sorry, I've been tweeting at him all day. Here's what his last tweet, and it was from, it says 2 hours ago. I think it was longer than that. Reads, Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier have scored a number of scoops for BuzzFeed on the Trump Tower Moscow project, but the intense attention has also resurfaced Leopold's checkered past. My story. His story is shit. It is bullshit. I hope Jason gets a good lawyer and sues the crap out of this Oliver Darcy guy, who apparently used to work at Glenn Beck's The Blaze. Yes, he is a right-wing whatever he is. I loathe to call him a journalist because he's not a journalist, but he should be fired. So I've been tweeting at CNN. I wrote them a complaint letter and everything. Just how sickening that Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier broke this amazing story. President Trump, sorry, it's what it says in the headline. I usually don't put those two words together. Directed his attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. Now, the two of these reporters have been writing about this Moscow Trump Tower project for a long time. Go back to BuzzFeed News and read it. And realize what a treasure we have in Jason Leopold. God, it pisses me off. All right. But you know what? I would have invited Jason on the show today, as I wrote to him in a message right after the story broke last night. Figures I'm overbooked for today. But we'll bring it up. We do have a good show for you. In fact, let's get Will Bunch on the line, if this will work. I'm sorry. I'm having one of those days. I'm having one of those years. So Will Bunch, you know, again, if you listen to this program for any amount of time, you've heard Will Bunch. He is a columnist, a syndicated columnist. He writes for the National Enquirer. Oh no, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Big, big difference there. The Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, and Philly.com. He's the author of a couple of books, including Tear Down This Myth and The Burn Identity. And he's a frequent guest on this program because his columns are so good. Now, Will Bunch has written a few other columns in the week since the one we're going to talk about ran. But it's the one I keep thinking about, and it makes me really sad. So, first of all, hi, Will Bunch. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Nicole, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, and Happy New Year. We haven't spoken since the new year began, such as it is.
Yeah. Which seemed, New Year's Day seems like it was about 4 months ago.
Yeah, and in Trump time, it was.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, hopefully I'll write something this year interesting enough to make the National Enquirer.
Please. By the way, to the people who write, National Enquirer is with an E. Philadelphia Inquirer
Correct.
Is with an I. Just because that.
Thank you for that.
I see that all the time, and it's one of those things that makes my blood boil.
Yeah.
Before we get to the column that I want to talk to you about, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about this big story that I just mentioned, Jason Leopold's news bombshell. I loved your tweet from this morning that read, 5 years ago, who would have predicted that BuzzFeed would help take down a U.S. president with these 23 adorable high crimes and misdemeanors will, after impeachment, restore your faith in democracy? Regardless of the fun we make of BuzzFeed, you know, when Jason Leopold first told me he was going from Vice over to BuzzFeed, I said, really? He said, really? BuzzFeed News is apparently a wholly different operation than BuzzFeed listicles and
stuff.
Yeah,
you know, in fairness, it was
a joke.
That tweet of mine was a joke.
Yes,
I hope people took it in that
spirit.
Because, I mean, actually they've actually done pretty good journalism, speaking as a longtime journalist myself.
Mm-hmm.
Really, since their inception, you know, I mean, their editor in chief, Ben Smith, is a former New York Daily News hard news guy, and you know, I mean, they did the listicle thing back when that's what they
right. And BuzzFeed, the main website, still does that, but BuzzFeed News is a separate entity. I mean, they're all under the same heading, but the news division is Serious News,
right? And it just. I mean, the lesson is that in this media environment, trust is earned. You know,
yep.
And I think some smaller or newer or more kind of upstarty news organizations can win your trust if they do the right kind of journalism, like BuzzFeed clearly has on this story. And then, you know, the flip side of that is other news organizations, you know, like the New York Times occasionally, or.
Yep.
Even the Guardian, occasionally can lose your trust with a bad story. You
That's
know?
True.
So,
That's true. And what's really interesting is the New York Times has been just it's silent on this story. They haven't reported on it one way or another, which I guess they're doing their own fact checking or they've got their own story ready to drop. But, you know, I guess being silent
than having one
of your right-wing so-called reporters put out a hit piece on one of the reporters who broke what might be the story that brings down Donald Trump.
Yeah, that was very distressing. I don't even want to, like, really give much credence by talking about that. But, you know, one of the reporters overcame some personal difficulties, which is what we want to see.
And he wrote about it. He wrote a book about it. I've talked about it on this show. Right. It's not like he's trying to hide anything.
I mean, exactly.
It's unbelievable.
But, the New York Times is having this story. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, it's complicated because when one news organization has a big scoop, and this has really been one of the two or three biggest scoops of the entire Trump era, really, I think. But when a news organization has a scoop like that, and you kind of wait for other news organizations to match it, and they don't, it can mean one of two wildly different things, which is it either means that the initial news organization spent so much time thoroughly reporting it and that their sources are so deeply implanted in the thing that it's just the kind of thing that even the New York Times just can't go out and match it in a day. So that's the best case scenario. And I believe that's happened. I believe that's happened with several stories recently. Some of the McClatchy news service reporting on whether Michael Cohen went to Prague or not.
That's right.
I mean, I just think McClatchy has an impeccable reputation as a news organization. And so the fact that those stories haven't been matched, I still have a lot of faith in McClatchy. I still think that they may be proven right on that, but we'll see. On the other hand, and I say this with just all kinds of feelings because through a long chain of events I won't get into, I actually columnized on this during the brief period where everybody thought this report was true, and now I seriously doubt it. I mentioned The Guardian earlier, and that's because of their report about Paul Manafort meeting with Julian Assange, mm-hmm. which, you know, it happened to break right when I was on column deadline, and I just started a column that I didn't really like that much, and I jumped on it and wrote a column about it, and nobody else has reported that. And when you think about it, it's kind of a far-fetched thing, and the fact that nobody else has matched the story, you know, that I think is a case where the fact that nobody matched that story should raise all kind of red flags for you. But, you know, I mean, the BuzzFeed story is just very much in line with what's already been out there in terms of, I mean, Michael Cohen pled guilty just a month or two ago to the underlying charge here, which is lying to Congress about the Trump Tower Russia.
Yep.
And, you know, people keep saying, you know, Mueller has a plan. Mueller, you know, that, you know, we mere mortals haven't been let into it. But trust us, Mueller has a plan. And that sounds kind of crazy, but it's kind of right. And this is, you know, now you see why, you know, if Michael Cohen met with prosecutors, what was it, 19 times or some multiple times that he met with prosecutors to share information. And he's been indicted now for two things, basically, or pled guilty and charged with two things. The campaign, the Stormy Daniels campaign finance violation and kind of related crimes. And then also lying to Congress about Trump Tower Russia. And both of these crimes, we now have reason to believe, were conspiracies that were led and directed by Donald Trump.
Right.
So
right.
Clearly, if Mueller is encircling Trump, he's, you know, I'm sure Michael Cohen told him about other instances of wrongdoing, but these are the ones, it seems, that draw the straightest line to Trump.
Yeah. No, I think so, too. And it looks like, you know, he's being further and further pushed into a corner. And good. So we'll wait and see how this develops. But he looks like a wounded, you know, feral animal trying to scratch and claw his way out. And he's going to keep making mistakes. Anyway, Will Bunch, today...
Today you
have a column about the LA teacher strike, which I guess has been a long time coming. But what I wanted to discuss was the column you wrote just a little over a week ago. It was January 10th, because it's the one that stuck with me. It's entitled, Bernie Sanders is the Leader America Needs Now, Just Not by Running for President in 2020. And Will, I get where you're coming from. But my God, when I look at the other candidates, both declared and potential candidates, there's no one who lives up to him. There's no one who I think can motivate the crowds the way he does. There's no one who can just appeal to our sense of the greater good. I mean, I just can't find anyone who stacks up against him.
I hear you on that, and, you know, as I knew was going to happen, I totally expected, you know, I've gotten quite a lot of feedback from writing the column, and honestly, it wasn't quite as angry as I thought it would be, to be honest.
No, but you know what? Because I kind of get what you're saying. I understand the logic behind it. I honestly...
Let me just say something to your point, that I mean, which is... In hindsight, the only thing, if I wrote the column today as opposed to 5 days ago, the only thing I might add or say differently is I probably shouldn't put in the caveat that if this Democratic race unfolds and really nobody does emerge who I think is really, truly and honestly carrying the Bernie Sanders 2016 and 2020 agenda forward, in the way that needs to happen, I would absolutely reconsider my position. You know, if he's the only one, if he decides to run, which I do think he's still leaning towards deciding to run, does run, and like you said, if he's the only one who is energizing crowds, and if he's the only one who has the right positions on the issues, I would absolutely reconsider. My counter to that, though, is I kind of don't think it's going to exactly play out that way. I mean, I think the vast majority of A-list Democratic candidates who are out there are, for, you know, I mean, everybody's different, and but I think most of them are pursuing platforms that I think are just extremely close to what Bernie ran on in 2016 mm-hmm. in terms of Medicare for all, yep. College affordability, $15 minimum wage. I mean, to me, those are kind of the big three. And, you know, obviously there's, you know, it's going to be, when you drill down deeper, there's going to be differences between all of them. But I really think that he succeeded in moving the party. And in terms of the energy, I don't doubt he'll still get big enthusiastic crowds if he goes out has rallies and
speaks.
No, he absolutely will. But I do feel in terms of the energy that really matters. I mean, you know, I tried to stay pretty close to the ground during the midterms, and the energy I saw came from, a kind of a resistance movement that was, I mean, it was heavily female, you know, in nature, and it was a movement that I feel wanted a Bernie-style program, but also wanted it in a new face, you know, in a new personality.
Right.
That they're looking for that they want the same. That I think you've got a Democratic base that pretty much has moved around to Bernie's positions on the issues, but I think in terms of who is the best to put those issues out there as to first of all, and most importantly, of course, you know, defeat Donald Trump if Trump makes it to 2020, and or defeat Mike Pence or whoever and win the election in 2020. Who's the best person to do that, and who's going to be the best person to advance those ideas as president of the United States? And I think there's a lot of energy towards the base of, you know, let's have liberalism that's pretty much in the Bernie mode, but let's get a younger or more diverse person out there.
But I'm asking who. I get that argument.
Well,
I get
that.
I believe, look, I've had this thing over the last week. I've been dealing with ageism. I had applied for a local radio job. And it sucks getting old, because I heard from literally hundreds.
Nicole, I'm turning 60. And
I know.
Today,
we're the same age.
I hear you.
The same age.
Yeah, I know. So I'm not. I'm not a 23-year-old.
No, I get that, so it pains me to say this. I think Bernie's too old. I know he's healthy. He's got the stamina of more stamina than many half his age, but I think he's too old. And I get what you wrote, Will, about, you know, it's time for him to be like the spiritual leader, to be the fatherly figure. But I don't. And 4 years ago, or 6 years ago now, I was really one of the people beating the drums for Elizabeth Warren before Bernie jumped in. I wanted Elizabeth Warren to run because I really thought it was her time and she could have won.
The people for Bernie group and the people who, and I love those people, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of nervous whether they're still talking to me now or not. I guess I'll find out over the coming weeks. But you have to understand that that group started out as people for Elizabeth Warren.
I know.
And
yep. It was ready for Warren.
Yeah,
ready
for Warren.
I still have some of their posters and stickers and stuff here. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So it's complicated, right? I mean, I you said something when, you know, because you said with great passion, you know, if not Bernie, who? And
I think we have,
even though time moves both slowly and quickly in the Trump era, I do think the primaries will reveal, you know, you're going to have just an insane number of people running. And I think the primaries will be a good sorting process. And, you know, like I said, I could be totally off base about this. I mean, the primaries could come and everybody else but Bernie could just fall short of the standard he set in 2016. But the campaign that I thought was truly historic. I mean, I wrote the Bernie Identity, a short ebook about mm-hmm. because I wanted to capture. I mean, I sensed from in the middle of 2015, I really sensed the historic nature of his candidacy, and I wanted to capture that, you know. So and that's never going to change, you know. But I do think times have changed in other ways, and I think you have to acknowledge that. And you know, I know, and I'm not alone in feeling this way. You know, I was actually shocked to read a Boston Globe story that came out the day after my column that quoted me, but also even more so quoted Jonathan Tessini, who was, you know, Mr. Bernie in 2016, who also wrote a book and was on the
Pardon my bluntness, but nobody gives a shit who Jonathan Tessini is. Nobody knows who he is. He ran for Congress a million years ago. He wrote a book and he followed.
I understand. Yeah. I understand that. But my point is not pumping him up or knocking him down, but I'm just saying that, you know, I think it's, you know, and also I've just talked to people anecdotally and you know, a lot of people I know who are pro Bernie, and the way I feel is not unusual. You know, I'm not like putting myself out there.
No, because I kind of agree with you.
Lot of people who were enthusiastic about, you know, it was a different environment. I mean, it's a different situation when the choice was Bernie or Hillary versus what we're looking at now, the situation we're looking at now.
Yeah, but here's what's got me. I knew about all the last weekend, there were all the, you know, urge Bernie to run kind of get-togethers. I went 4 years ago or 6 years ago, whenever it was now, and did it enthusiastically. This time I didn't show up because I'm not sure. I love Bernie. I still think his ideas are the ones that will win. And I know maybe it makes me a hypocrite. I wish he were 10 years younger. Because there's a big difference between 60 and 80, which is about what he'll be at election time. And I get, as the chat room is telling me, that, well, his vice president could take over. Yeah, who's that? And why don't you elect that person if they're so capable of being president? This is what, and it pains me because I look at everyone else. Elizabeth Warren, I think, lost a lot of credibility when she got behind Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Although I still give her credit for not endorsing Hillary Clinton before Bernie dropped out, because you have to know how much pressure she was under. But she's too good at being the politician instead of being the person that you just inherently believe, and that works against her. And the rest of them, I see them all together. Kirsten Gillibrand should go home now because she's a phony hypocrite. You look at how much money so many of these people have taken. They talk a good game, but they're full of shit. And I want somebody with Bernie Sanders' ideals. And right now, frankly, that leaves me with Bernie and Elizabeth Warren.
Right. And yeah, and I understand your concerns about Warren. Although I have to say, you know, I've been on kind of the arc with her. I mean, I think her policy initiatives that she's put out so far, and you know, I don't know. I guess I'm old fashioned. I'm a policy guy. I mean that's why. I think Beto O'Rourke is great. I think he'd be a great senator.
Yeah, except his votes are lousy.
It'd be exciting, but I just want to see so much more of what he actually stands for. And you know, and I haven't even written a column about him yet, but I just, you know, made some observations on Twitter a month or two ago about Beto and got a lot of feedback, and everybody was saying, oh, but he's so charismatic and he can raise money and he can lead. And I get all of that. And, you know, and I mean, I guess people were saying the same things about John F. Kennedy 60 years ago and all of that. But I don't know. I just feel like you got to have something. You got to show me something on the policy front.
Right.
You know?
I agree. Yeah, and I see
a lot of people don't, though. That's the thing.
Right. And it's just so interesting reading the messages in the chat room. This is the YouTube chat room. Gillibrand fucked up with her treatment of Franken. I agree with that, but I think her problems are bigger than that. Someone said, yeah, charisma is way more important than cracking down on corporate corruption, shaking my head. It's not that it's more important, but you've got to be electable. And against Donald Trump, sorry, you need some kind of charisma. It's not going to be Jeff Merkley, who might be a smart guy, might be great on policy, but he's boring as hell. He's not going to be able to go up against Donald Trump. Someone said Sherrod Brown is a progressive. I like him. Like, personally, I like him. Read his policies. People don't educate themselves. That's what kills me. That's what got me about this whole Beto O'Rourke thing. Look at his votes. Read what David Sirota wrote. I know it's on vogue to criticize David Sirota today, but he wrote a big article based on Beto's voting record over three terms in Congress, and it kind of sucks.
I think people's voting records are absolutely fair game, and they should be discussed.
Yep.
And I do think the flip side of that, though, I would say I also think that we shouldn't necessarily cast these people in stone from their past. I think we should give them breathing space to evolve. Like I mean, Beto's voting record is not great, right? But then
no, it sucks.
But when you look at the campaign he ran for Senate in Texas,
yeah, he was good because he listened to people.
You know, it was good.
He listened to the people that he met with.
He listened. I think he understood the zeitgeist, and I think how at least certainly the Democratic constituency was feeling, and mm-hmm. you know, so for him, I mean, not that it's the make or break issue of all time, but I mean, for him to speak frankly about the whole Colin Kaepernick situation and mm-hmm. race,
yep, was great.
I mean, that was something that 99 out of 100 political consultants would have like pulled him aside and ordered him not to do, but he did it anyway,
right.
You know, and I think it does show that people can change and evolve. So I think that's the equation for voters. They have to decide. It's like you shouldn't and you can't ignore somebody's record, because that gives you some indication of who they really are. But I think you also can and should give them a little room to evolve, that, you know, because our politics are evolving, you know. I mean, when you go back 25 years and you look at almost every major Democrat being against gay marriage, for example, I think we've given, you know, people like Obama some room to evolve on these issues. And there was, you know, I mean, there's a lot of cynical politics both before and since, you know, on an issue like that. But, the targets move, you know, it's not a fixed equation.
Yep.
You know?
And we still
people rise. I mean, think about it. I was thinking about it the other day. It's like, you know, I'm a history freak and a student of the Vietnam War era, you know, and a lot of people who were, you know, kind of cold warriors in the 1950s, you know, during Vietnam came to realize that war was wrong and came out against it. And, you know, I think when you make a decision like that, you should get credit for understanding the situation and changing with the times and feeling that you've educated yourself rather than, you know, holding people rigidly accountable.
But there's a question as to whether or not they've evolved on issues, or they're just pandering to what the polls say that the people want to hear. And that's what we have to judge.
That's what we the voters have to figure out.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And I hate it that we've got almost 2 years to deal with this going on. Will Bunch, always a pleasure. I will post a link to both that column that we were talking about Bernie, whether or not he should run, and also your latest one, the new one on the LA teacher strike, because that's really important.
Brilliant.
As well. Will Bunch, find him on the Twitters at @Will_Bunch. And I'll post links and all that at NicoleSandler.com. Thank you so much, Will, and Happy New Year.
Thanks for the call.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to check in with an old friend, Kelly Carlin. If the name sounds familiar, it should, because, yes, her dad was George. That's how I met her, is online. Got to know her because I don't remember how we came together, but she's been on the show a few times. I read her brilliant book, A Carlin Home Companion, went to see her one-woman show based on the book. But she's more than that, more than George's daughter. She's also, I don't want to say she's a therapist or a life coach, because those are two. We'll ask Kelly what she is. She's starting a new program called Women on the Verge. Sounds like it's tailor-made for me. Anyway, we'll take a break, check in with the news, and come back on the other side with Kelly Carlin next. Don't go away. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, shoot. I'm the wrong one. Hold on. We're going to get it for you. I thought I was going to do it live, but I'm not doing it live. So take two.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A bombshell of a story dropped late Thursday night, courtesy of Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier at BuzzFeed. They're reporting that Trump directed his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about a Trump Tower project in Moscow. Cohen pleaded guilty to lying to Congress. The story also says that Trump asked Cohen to set up a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin to kickstart the project, even as he claimed to not have any business dealings in the country. The BuzzFeed report cites two federal law enforcement officials as sources. It has not been independently corroborated by other news outlets or by special counsel Robert Mueller. Just moments after the story broke, shortly after 10 p.m. Eastern, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell was speaking with Jill Wine Banks, who was a Watergate prosecutor.
This is Michael Cohen giving the special prosecutor his own account of the president of the United States directing Michael Cohen while he's president, right from the Oval Office, to lie to Congress. This truly is a Nixonian moment.
This is absolutely one of those moments where you go, when is enough sufficient? This is when it is, because this is exactly the Watergate model of Nixon saying, you can always say, I don't remember, I don't recall, even though you do. That's subornation of perjury, plain and simple. It is a direct act of the president while he is president, interfering not only with an investigation, but of directly conspiring to obstruct justice. And this should be enough for even the, and remember, he lied, that is Cohen, he told Cohen to lie to the Senate. Even the Republican Senate is going to have to say, we've been had. We can't have him lying to us. And in the end of Watergate, it was the Republicans who went to Nixon and said, you have to resign or we will convict you in the Senate. And that's going to happen here.
BuzzFeed is now reporting that the House Intelligence Committee will investigate whether Trump ordered Cohen to lie to Congress. Cohen is set to return to Capitol Hill on February 7th. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal also has a weird story about Cohen, reporting that Michael Cohen paid a small polling firm to rig two online polls in favor of Trump, including one conducted by Matt Drudge. Cohen allegedly paid the director of Redfinch Solutions, LLC, with a Walmart shopping bag that contained at least $12,000 in cash and a boxing glove he said once belonged to a Brazilian mixed martial arts fighter. Cohen tweeted on Thursday that everything he did came under instructions from the president. So earlier this week, Nancy Pelosi sent Donald Trump a letter requesting that, due to security concerns because of the government shutdown, he move his State of the Union address to a later date after the government reopens, or perhaps he should consider delivering a written version of the speech. She added that he could deliver the address from the Oval Office. Trump, thinking that everything is a game, responded by abruptly canceling a long-planned congressional delegation to Brussels and Afghanistan just an hour before they were set to depart. CNN's Jake Tapper explains.
And the president violating decades of security protocols by publicly announcing ahead of time a secret trip to a war zone. A Republican member of Congress telling me just minutes ago that members of Congress are always told never divulge any trip to a war zone until after you have left the war zone. The move by the president was widely interpreted as a response to Pelosi suggesting yesterday a delay or cancellation of the president speaking to a joint session of Congress for the annual State of the Union address, which Pelosi said she was doing because it was unfair to force security agents to work the event without pay. The president kind of tried to borrow that excuse for his cancellation of her trip, writing, quote, in light of the 800,000 great American workers not receiving pay, I'm sure you would agree that postponing this public relations event is totally appropriate. Now, first off, we should note President Trump does not claim in that letter that those who would be transporting Pelosi in the congressional delegation are not being paid, because they are being paid. The defense spending bill was passed in 2018. Now, according to a spokeswoman for Speaker Pelosi, she and the delegation were stopping in Belgium and, quote, scheduled to meet with top NATO commanders, U.S. military leaders and key allies to affirm the United States' commitment to the NATO alliance. In Afghanistan, the spokesman said, quote, the purpose of the trip was to express appreciation and thanks to our men and women in uniform for their service and dedication, and to obtain critical national security and intelligence briefings from those on the front lines. A White House official tells CNN that Pelosi and members of Congress are welcome to fly commercial to Afghanistan, a remarkable statement given that the president just announced to the world, including the Taliban, that the Speaker of the House was headed there.
In case you were wondering, Trump didn't cancel his wife's flight via military aircraft to Mar-a-Lago in Florida for vacation. Priorities, people, priorities. A new report from the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security says the Trump administration may have taken thousands more immigrant children from parents and guardians at the border than was previously known, and it does not know how many families were separated in total. Lovely. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, I'm back. So, Kelly Carlin is, as her name suggests, the daughter of the one and only George Carlin. But she's so much more than that. Her website says she's a thinker, writer, talker, and doodler. She's funny, serious, silly, and deep. Sometimes she wishes she were a Carol Burnett. Other days it's Patti Smith, but mostly it's Oprah Winfrey. Intriguing, yes, but there's more. In addition to being a writer, performer, and podcaster, there's a whole spiritual teacher guide side of Kelly Carlin that a lot of people aren't aware of. Thankfully, I've had the opportunity to talk with Kelly on a number of occasions, so I've heard all the stories. Kelly Carlin, welcome back to the show.
Ah, Nicole, it is so lovely to be here.
And it's great to hear from you. I follow you on Twitter. I watch all your, you know, the way you're able to sort of straddle the funny with the would be funny if it weren't so deadly serious.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really been my life's work internally for myself, is to learn to bring sense of humor to things that we sometimes think are too reverent. So to bring some irreverence to it, and then, but also to really bring the reverence to the things that are kind of insane or irreverent or silly and goofy. So I really am half my mother and half my father, pretty much.
Well, I was going to say, we don't know as much about your mother as we know about your father. But that's basically what George did, isn't it? I mean, he was the most astute watcher of life. I mean, he would comment on the most mundane things and make us all go, yeah, that's right. And by the way you told us about it is just hysterically funny.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and his perspective was rarely from his own personal perspective. He didn't show a lot of himself, you know, his inside process or his inside wrestling with personal issues in his life like so many comics. But he brought an incredible, you know, I used to think like Zen Buddhist type of perspective, because he could sit so far outside the culture and witness the insanity of humanity in general and bring us to that place too and say, look how crazy and silly and goofy we are. And also, here's the small stuff that connects us, that makes us human and makes it all worthwhile too.
So, Kelly Carlin, in you wrote a book, your sort of life story, A Carlin Home Companion, which is just wonderful because, again, we see all sides. And there are so many of us who feel like we share George with you. We've known him, but we only know the public side of him. You know, you knew he was your dad and you were the only child. So you had a very unique, obviously, relationship, and you share with those of us hungry for more George Carlin, those sides of him that we didn't really know. And then you sort of, you translated that into a one-woman show that you toured with for a little while. We got to see it down here in West Palm Beach. But you also talk about how it's so important to be not just George's daughter. I can't even imagine the pressure that that would put on a person to have to at least feel like you're living up to the legend that was your father.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the last 10 years, my dad died in 2008, have absolutely been about those two very things, completely embracing that I am George Carlin's daughter, and what does that mean to me, and what does that mean in my internal life, internal structure, and also my life, you know, traveling around and meeting fans and social media, how that changed everything. But also a real wrestling with, yes, I am that, and who am I also? And who have I been hiding in the crevices and the corners of myself for years because I was literally in his shadow? So who have I been in this shadow world waiting to kind of come out into my own spotlight? And doing my solo show was both a real and metaphorical standing in my own spotlight place, and using my father's, my connection to my father to bring interest to the story. But like you saw with my show and with my book, it's my story ultimately, obviously, to tell. And so, and this is, you know, this is really the last couple of years since I donated his archives to the National Comedy Center and the book came out, paperback came out in 2016. I've had 2 years now to really wrestle with post being George Carlin's daughter in public. I made a real clean cut the summer of 2016 with that by going off of social media. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I said to the world, I know you love him. Thank you for loving him. And I cannot look at pictures, videos, or his name all day long anymore. Mm-hmm. It's too traumatizing.
Right.
He's my dead dad. He's my dead dad. And I need to move on. And let's, you know, let's please respect that. And everyone has. And it gave me real room to find out what's Kelly's next act, you know?
Right. And we're going to get to that. The way it came about to have you back on the show again, we hadn't spoken in a while. And I saw that you are putting together a new program, Women on the Verge. I thought of, obviously, George when a couple of weeks ago when there was this collective national outrage that a new freshman congresswoman dared to say, we're going to impeach the motherfucker. And they were more offended by the word motherfucker that came out of this young woman's mouth than they were over the fact that that Donald Trump needs to be impeached, because he does.
Yeah, and it's that false outrage right and the left love to play with.
That's right. And it came from both.
And that's why, that's why I loved my dad's perspective on language. You know, I mean, that's what he was known for, the seven dirty words and all of that. But that real, spotlight he would put on this outrage, this false outrage about the wrong thing from the left and the right. And which is why I loved him, because he didn't pick sides necessarily. He picked perspective.
That's right.
And made us all very aware of are we being true? Are we being integral? Are we being aligned with an overall perspective, or are we just picking sides to pick sides?
That's a great perspective. That's a way to look at it. And what I thought of immediately on hearing the outrage over the word motherfucker was the seven dirty words. And so I put together a little mix that I opened the show with. Of course, I got copyright violated by YouTube, but I wanted to make sure you were cool with it. And so when you said, I thought it was great, I felt better. And then, what I learned from the book and from our previous conversations was when George was still alive, you were trying to figure out, you know, as most young people do, what to do with your life. And part of you thought about going the comedian entertaining route. Part of you went to school to study psychology. And he was very supportive of that. Yes,
he was. He was, he dropped out of school in the eighth grade, and my academic achievements, I was always a straight A student. And then I went to UCLA and got my undergrad in my 20s. And then when I went to grad school, in my early 40s, he was very proud of it. You know, that really, just the academic achievement part of it, was really exciting. I was the first Carlin to get any kind of a degree. He and I had had a conversation, and it's something I had shared in the book and the solo show, where we'd had a conversation around higher power in AA, and it was when he was working on some stuff around that in his own life. And he had said to me, when I came up to talk to him about my perspective about what a higher power is, he said to me, I've always seen you as the shaman in this family. And it was such a beautiful moment for me, because he really did see me in that moment. He really saw my power to have a broad and wide and deep spiritual perspective, and to be able to see life through that lens and to bring a healing space to people to figure out their, you know, their own stuff. And so when I got my degree in my master's in Jungian psychology, he was thrilled by it all, really, really thrilled. And also thrilled because he knows how brutal the commercial entertainment industry is. And I think he always wanted to protect me from that. And I, you know, being a daughter, we take these signals from our parents and do what with them. And I always saw that resistance to the entertainment industry in him about me, about the fact that I wasn't quote unquote talented enough, but it wasn't that. It was a protection of the brutality of what this business will do to you. And so, the fact that I had a path that was outside and away from the entertainment industry, I think gave him some real peace of mind.
Hmm. Well, it's a tough business. I mean, my God, everybody knows.
Well,
that.
And they commercialize your soul. I mean, that's what they do. They take art and they make it about making money. And, you know, there's nothing worse. I think all of us in our life on some level know what it feels like when we're compromising or sacrificing our soul for something else. And I think we all walk that line between how do we create security and safety and financial stability and not sell our soul.
Yeah. Well, let me know when you find out. I could use that. So, Kelly Carlin, you've done a number of, you do these, they're not seminars. They're, I guess, workshops might be a way to put it.
Yeah, I do webinars. That's what they've been the last 2 years or so. I started in the summer of 2016. I started teaching meditation online on Sundays, and I still do that. It's called Sunday Unplug. People can find that through my Patreon page. So I've been doing that consistently. And I do a couple of other things like that. And that got me like really seeing like, oh, I could do this and I can be Kelly. I can be irreverent. I can say the word fuck and also teach meditation.
Yep.
And I bring humor to it and a really safe, big space. And that was fun. And then last year I started really wanting to do something for women since I graduated grad school in 2004. And a lot of the reason I wrote my book and did my solo show was to show the world and show women and everyone in particular, but I am a woman making my way through the world and I've always felt like a woman on the verge. And so I really wanted to bring all of my academic studies, my personal experiences, all the things I've learned from all the teachers the last 20 years around what it takes to be a woman and to find ourselves, to really connect to our power and voice and authority and to come from that place and then go out into the world from there. And so I wanted to create a safe place for women to do that. One of the things clearly in my book and my solo show is about is that our family of origin, you know, we make a lot of unconscious and tacit agreements with our parents at very young ages to help our family survive. Mm-hmm. And I was an only child. So I kind of became the early adult. I kind of gave up my childhood. Both my parents were addicts and I became the wise one. And so I sacrificed a lot of my own needs and my own even connection to know how to determine what I need or want. And that my adult life has really been a reconnection to all of that. And then on top of that, we have what the culture shoves down our throat as women, who we're supposed to be, what we're allowed to say, where, do from, you know, from day one. And each generation is slightly different. I'm a mid-50s, so I'm right between the baby boom and the Gen X.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these messages we get that are finally changing in a big way right now, but they're still there. It's still a patriarchal, you know, male-based, male-centric power base. And so there's some dismantling to look at around the culture and the family of origin messages, what we've internalized, these rules, these regulations, these contracts. So, and that's a lot of what my book is about, is me struggling with trying to renegotiate some of that within me and find my place in the world, find my voice, find my sense of authority separate from family, separate from culture. What is it that Kelly really wanted to do in this life? And so I really wanted to create a year-long safe space for women to do that. And so my tagline for my business, Women on the Verge, go deep to make the leap. So there's some deep diving work we do. And then there's also some taking risks with, you know, how do we do things different in the world? And how do we love ourselves as we move out into the world, or love ourselves differently while in relationship with family? And what I've found is that I work with women in transition, women who want something different in the next phase of their life, whether they're empty nesters, mm-hmm. or there is a career change or retirement or divorce, or they've just been through a major illness, whatever it is. But that space where we know it's time to reinvent ourselves, there's a door opening, there's a crack. And I want to help them walk through into the room and say, okay, let's take a year. How do you want to reinvent yourself? Who do you want to discover lives inside of you? Who's never had a voice? And how do you want to move her forward out into the world now?
Wow. I mean, it sounds great. And you do this online the same way you do the Sunday morning things, or how does that work?
I do it online. It's not just open to the public. There's mm-hmm. a little bit of screening that has to go on. I have a one-on-one conversation with women about where they're at and if this program works. If anyone's interested, you can go to womenontheverge.com. You'll see there's a way to have a conversation with me about this. And then I take it online, and the content is online. It's in a private area. It's on a private website. I teach through a portal called Rizuku. So there's confidentiality and privacy. There's chances to coach with me in one-on-one or group settings, or also big community calls. I'm very intimate online with the discussion forums. We're always discussing and unpacking things. And it's a full one-year program. Wow. So that there's a lot of time to take the time to really unpack, get to know yourself, get to bond with the group. Part of it is about community, being with other women doing this. Multi-generational. I have everyone from 30-somethings to a 75-year-old woman. So it's really a beautiful, eclectic group of women. And we do, we go deep, we go in, we look at things, we look at our old stuff, we decide how we want to reposition ourselves, create new aspects, or reintroduce ourselves to old aspects of ourselves that we've lost. Because I'm trained in Jungian psychology, I love the mythology stuff. We work around the sacred feminine. We work around archetypes, some dream work. It's psycho, it's psychological, it's spiritual, but it's also practical, you know, there's a practical element to it too.
Right. So now people can also get there at kellycarlin.com, which has more of everything you do. It's an all-inclusive website. But if you go to Kelly, the teaching tab, you'll find all the courses and everything. But this website can keep you occupied for quite a while.
Yes, and because I have all my solo show and my book stuff on my website, you know, I really wanted to create a website that's got all the parts of me. You know, I mean, I'm certainly a multi-person, as most of us are these days. And I know in a few years I will turn back to being on a stage and writing again. Yeah. I know there's another book in me. I know there's another solo show. And it will probably come a lot from this work here, because I want to tell the story of what the last 10, 11 years has been like for me to find my voice on a stage and to be able to tell my story and to give that gift to me and the healing that happened because of it.
Right. And you know, you have your own stuff to deal with. I mean, I would imagine most people think, wow, you grew up with George Carlin as your dad. How amazing is that? But you know what demons were involved in that as well. And that's something you've probably had to work through your whole life.
Absolutely. And that's certainly in A Carlin Home Companion. I talk a bit about that up to my dad's death.
Most definitely. I highly recommend it. Kelly Carlin, it's great talking with you. Again, people can find you at kellycarlin.com. I'll put links on my blog at nicolesandler.com. They can also follow you on Twitter at Kelly_Carlin, because you're not taking a break right now. You're tweeting your fingers off.
I am.
And it's always great to see you. Kelly Carlin, thank you so much. I'm about to have a coughing attack here for some reason.
Thanks, Nicole. Always, thank you.
Always great to talk with you. Really appreciate it. Take care. Kelly Carlin, everybody. And again, I'll put all the links on my blog at nicolesandler.com. Check her out. I did one webinar with Kelly. And while I kept pretty quiet, because I can be shy in those kind of situations, it definitely helped. She's really good at what she does. And so if you're looking for something like that, And we all should be. Do check her out at kellycarlin.com. All right, and that does it for us for the day, for the week. Try to have a wonderful weekend. I don't even know what to expect. So we'll see if we're still standing come Tuesday when I'll be back with Gotta Laugh. I guess keep the faith, baby. Hold tough and we'll get through this mess together, perhaps. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will see you Tuesday. Take care. Bye-bye.